So yesterday Heather gave a talk on the first foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body. So today is the second foundation of mindfulness, which is sometimes said to be translated into English as mindfulness of feelings. And the Pali word is vedana. As an introduction to this topic and the context for why it's a useful topic for mindfulness, I'd like to start with the analogy of making a fist. You don't have to do this, but you know, making a really good fist. And a fist is useful for some things. Early in life, it's useful as a way of having a temper tantrum, which some kids seem to think is useful. It's useful if you want to punch someone out. That's usually what you have to do, is make a fist. It's useful, some people do it to restrain themselves. If they want to control themselves, you know, like they not do something, say something, do something, they'll tighten up the fist, and that seems to somehow keep the energy or something contained. It's useful if you're really ticklish in the palm of your hand. It's useful when the kids can't get to you. So it's a protection. So it has its usefulness. There is a time and place, maybe, that having a fist is a good idea. But if we go around life with a fist, the hand is pretty limited, what it can do. And you know, most of the things we use our hands for, we can't do very well. It's always clenched in a fist. And one of the things that happens when the hand is in a fist is that the most sensitive and delicate and softest part of the hand is not exposed, is not available to feel and touch. Some of the most lovely things we can do with a hand can't really be done so well with a fist. Maybe if you're really, really careful and slow and tender, but usually if we're going to, you know, shake hands or touch someone on the cheek or, you know, on their back, usually do that with an open hand. You know, that usually expresses something very nice. The very traditional way of showing people that you're harmless, or even dogs that you're harmless, is to show an open palm. Someone went once very seriously, he was dead set serious to have a fight with me. And without thinking of what to do, I was just kind of, this was pretty serious stuff. I dropped down on one knee and opened up my hands and with palms towards him and said, "I can't fight." So I was, you know, kind of in a defenseless position, lower than him, my hands open. And he walked away in disgust. But there was no fight. And then the fingers, the beautiful, wonderful fingers and thumb that we have, the opposable thumb, you know, can do a lot of amazing things when we unclench the fist. So there's a time that maybe a fist is useful. One of the things that kind of the movement of a fist is useful for is to hold on to things. And so we hold on to things, carry things, we pick things up and give them to other people. We have a hand so we can receive it, and we take it in our hand. And it's kind of like, more, not exactly a, you know, a tight fist, but we use it to grab onto and hold. And that's good. So, you know, you can pick up something like this little striker with a bell, and it's useful to hold it. I can hit the bell. You know, it's kind of hard to use the striker without holding it. But if I walked around all day holding it, you know, it's, there's also, again, there's a limitation to what my hand can be used for. It's not, you know, it's, I don't think I can have my soup with this too well. You know, I have to be able to put it down and pick up the spoon. It's all kinds, you know, all kinds of things, right? But so I hold on to it tight, and you know, I have to put it down. So anyway, this analogy works the same way for the mind. That we, mind forms a fist. The mind grasps on, clings to things, all kinds of things. If it only, our mind had only two hands, it'd be really simple. We could only hold on to two things. But the mind seems to have lots and lots and lots of hands, so there's a lot of things we cling to and hold on to. Most people, there's no shortage of things. No shortage of movements of clenching and holding and tight. And some of them are you know, maybe useful at one point, but then they become a habit or a condition that we think are necessary forever. I don't know if this is the best example, but when I went to high school, it seemed like in my limited eyes of what I could see in high school, everyone was grouped together into their groups around a certain identity. There was the athletes, we had names for them, but I wasn't one of them, so. You know, and there was, you know, there were all kinds of different groups, right? And there was a certain identity that went with it, certain clothes, certain mannerisms, certain things that went along with it. And, you know, the my desire to be have friends and be part of a group were pretty ordinary, normal part of that. And so part of what that took was, you know, I joined a group that kind of liked me a little bit. And so I latched on to that identity, that way of being that worked for my group. And I don't know if it was my true self, you know, it involved having a brown leather jacket, a motorcycle, and a group of friends that had motorcycles. And I wouldn't say we were a motorcycle gang, exactly, but, you know, leather jackets and motorcycles and Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, you know, it was something. And so that was an identity that I had, that I held on to. And I suppose it served me at the time. I had my little group. We had fun. Except when we didn't. And at some point, I let go of it. And I probably wouldn't be sitting in front of you now if I hadn't. And so I let go of that identity. When, you know, so that was kind of acquired. Some identities were given to me, and some were held on to quite innocently, without a lot of tight grasping, but I held on to them and they limited me. The one I like to say was in seventh grade, my art teacher looked at me drawing in class and matter-of-factly, without any charge, without any, like she's the authority, she knew, and I didn't feel any malice or anything like this shouldn't be this way at all. I said, okay, that's how it is. She said, Gil, you have no artistic ability. It didn't bother me. It hadn't occurred to me I was supposed to. And just like, you know, that's the way it is. And okay, but that became part of my identity. I kind of assumed that was true. And for the next, I don't know, 6-7 years, I carried that with me. That's who I was. I was a person no artistic ability, until my dorm mate. In college, he was a born-again artist. evangelist, whatever. And so in the course of the year that we roomed together, he managed to somehow by the end of that first year, I was taking art classes. And it turned out that I had some artistic ability, and more importantly, I could have fun with it. I enjoyed myself. And so I was freed from holding on to that identity, that way of being. Or now that I'm thinking of these stories of my childhood, I hope it's okay to tell you. examples of clinging. I'm saying it partly with the idea that you'll find yourself in these stories, recognize yourself, in different ways, that you also perhaps have held on to things. And there's also the negative holding on, in a sense, because when I was, maybe 14 or 15, kind of the first time that I became interested in a girl, kind of romantically, a little bit, it was not much, not that I knew anything, but I mentioned it at dinner table in my family, and it was taken as kind of a joke. I was kind of like, they kind of laughed and made a little bit fun of it, I guess, and it was so painful for me to have that I closed something down inside of me. And I wasn't going to open that again to my parents. So all my teenagehood, I never mentioned anything about to them at home about dating or doing anything with girls. And that was like, I wasn't going to risk that again. There was maybe it was just the wrong moment in my development to have said it and be responded that way. And then I was sent to a boarding school for a little while. It was in a spectacularly beautiful place in the mountains. And I was 15, I believe. And I was walking this beautiful, beautiful, looking at the skies and the mountains, and I was walking with an older boy, 17-year-old, and I said to him, I looked around and said, why are we here in this world? This awe. Why are we here? What's this about? And he looked at me and said, don't be silly. And so something inside of me closed. I tightened up, I grasped, and and it took a while before that part opened up again for me. So there's so many different causes and conditions for why we grasp, we close up, we cling to things. I kind of have believed that many of the original first times that we grasp or cling in all the different hands in the mind, it was a good reason for it. There was a good, we're trying to protect ourselves, take care of ourselves, do something that was what we thought was in our best interest. And maybe it was at the time. But then if it gets stuck, if it stays that way, then it becomes like a clenched fist that has limited use. And the most sensitive and softest parts of who we are not then available. And we're not available to the world with open hands, with useful hands, with open mind, open heart, useful mind, to be able to negotiate and involve all the different ways that we can be in the world. Because as you know, a fist can only do so much. A tight, closed heart can only do so much. So, at the center of this enterprise of mindfulness practice, kind of the retreat, what we're trying to do, kind of the purpose of it, is to be involved in the process of unclenching, of unclinging, to learn something about ourselves so that we understand what clinging is and how it happens, how it works, what it feels like. And to learn how to relax and let go and clench. And to even more so, to learn not to do it again, to stay open. It's a beautiful process to learn. I think it's one of the noblest and most beautiful things to do, because clinging and not clinging is kind of like close to the foundation of, or is it, many, many of the things that we do in our lives. And sometimes it's really good to get down to the foundation, the origin, the source, rather than, it's like, you could, Yeah, just the source of things, the origins of things. And sometimes if you get down to the common denominator, you can solve the problem a lot easier. And so, you know, the simple thing of whether cling or don't cling is kind of like, you know, we can cling to all kinds of complicated things. And some of you are amazingly sophisticated and bright and really clever and can come up with the most amazingly complex stories and events and reasons. And, you know, and probably I have to take an advanced philosophy class in order to be able to engage you in why you think you have to cling, you know, at the story level. But it's still clinging. And so it's possible to, you know, drop below the philosophy and the reasons and the stories and justifications and just look at the simple movement of clinging and release of clinging and learn about it. And one of the first things, one of the very unfortunate things about Dharma practice is the unfortunate thing is that in order to learn about clinging, you have to study it. And it, you can study other people's clinging. That works for a while, as long as you don't tell them. But really, it's a matter of learning your own. So it's not such good news because, you know, that's, you know, it hurts to cling. It's uncomfortable to cling. It's embarrassing to cling. We'd rather not be the person who clings. But there's a lot of wisdom and a lot of maturity and honesty that can come by just taking your time and being willing to admit, I'm a clinging kind of person. That's what I'm doing. I'm holding on. I'm attached to something now. I have a desire. I have a compulsion. I have a need. And then to study it, to get to know it respectfully, kindly. It's possible that part of who you are that's clinging, resisting, closed down, maybe what it most needs from you is respectful attention. Who knows what it needs, but I have put a tremendous value in respectful attention, caring attention. Just look at it, be with it. And then with that as a foundation, then perhaps there can be beginning of unraveling, opening up. I'm fond of it's a different metaphor, I apologize, but I'm very fond of the word to thaw. It's, you know, the ice thaws, the clenching begins to thaw. It's kind of a gradual process. One of the things that I used to cling to when I was on retreat, meditating, was the idea that there was going to be a moment where it would all get better. And I'd sit there like a cat in front of the mouse hole, right? Kind of like watching and waiting for that moment where I was going to see that let go and I was going to be free. And, you know, I didn't have a clue how to do it, but, you know, I was just like, if I just huff and puff and get concentrated or do something, you know, it'll just, you know, it'll disappear and I'll be happy ever after. And I'd be waiting. And then a bell would ring, I'd get up and go walk or go have lunch or come back and sit down to meditate. And after sitting there for a little while, something would dawn on me, it's gone, that particular thing. Where'd it go? I didn't see where, I was waiting for, I was going to watch it go away. And I had to do that, see that a lot before I gave up this attachment to thinking I had to see it and that there was this magic moment. To just trust the process much more of being mindful and the thawing process. Who knows when we let go sometimes. So this is kind of one of the primary things we're doing here, is this respectful seeing, being present for ourselves, and then eventually when the time is right, to learn about the nature of our clinging and the holding and the nature of letting go and the nature of what it's like not to cling. To begin to appreciate and value what it's like not to cling, what it's like not to be clenched, resisting, closed down. In the small little ways we begin feeling that, to appreciate it, take that in, to be informed by that, to let it register in the heart what that's like, to get a sense of it is a really significant thing. So the mindfulness, the foundations of mindfulness are part of the wonderful process of learning to do this. And the body is a very powerful and significant ally and support, friend in this process. The body can help a lot, keep you in the present moment. It keeps you connected to what's going on. The body informs you in many ways how you cling, that you're clinging. There was a woman who came to me recently and said, I've been around the scene for a while now, for, I don't know, it's 9 months or so, and everyone, you and everyone else, keeps talking about the mind and the body and how they're, they're not so separate. And I don't get it. And she was sitting there in her chair talking to me, and she was kind of hunched over, shoulders were kind of tense, she was leaning forward, and she had her hands under her thighs, sitting on her hands, and her legs were crossed, and her toes were pressed up against the, hard up against the legs of the chair. So I said to her, why don't you close your eyes? And just don't move. And now, what do you feel in your body? And she said, I feel a lot of tension. So I feel the tension for a while. And then I said, why don't you, with your eyes closed, change your posture so that you're sitting in a posture that expresses ease and dignity. Ease and dignity. And so she rearranged herself and uncrossed her legs and sat up straight in the chair. And I said, now what do you feel now? And she's kind of touched her heart. And I said, I feel open here now. I feel this openness in my heart in this way. And I said, well, where do you feel? I said, it's kind of a rhetorical question, but where do you feel that openness? And she was touching her heart. Oh, here, on my chest. That's your body, I said. And that's how you know you're open. That's how you feel the openness, is being connected to your body here. And then I asked her, what have you learned from this little exercise? And she said, oh, I see that the mind and body are not so separate. It's important to be connected to both. So mindfulness of the body is very important, because partly it gives us access to recognizing how we feel. We can know when we're clinging, we can know when we're not clinging, we can know the feelings, what it's like to be clinging. That's part of the study. And we can know what it's like not to cling, the sensations, the inner sensations of not clinging. We can know these things. So the word vedana, V-E-D-A-N-A, vedana, literally means something, we say often in English, feeling, but literally it means something like a way of knowing. Like some of you know the ancient Indic texts called the Vedas, which means the knowledge. And so comes to the same word, vedana, way of knowing. It's connected to the English word through the Indo-European connections, the word wit. And it's a way of knowing. And so it's one of the ways of knowing we can cultivate. And it's one of those ways of knowing, to know something that, again, is a common denominator of our experience. And so often it can make things a lot easier if we connect to the common denominator of what's going on. And a common denominator of our experience is what's sometimes in English called the feeling tone. So it's not feelings like emotions, but rather the feeling tone, sometimes said. Occasionally you see it translated as hedonic tone, but that doesn't go over too well. It's not so popular. And what it means is that whether things, whatever we experience, has one of three qualities. So the common denominator of all experience, anything we can call an experience that you can know directly, when you're connected directly here, it has one of three qualities. It can be either pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. And apparently there's no other option. Because if it's not, if it's not pleasant, maybe it's the opposite, which is pleasant. But if it's neither, it's this kind of in-between thing, neither pleasant or unpleasant. Can you think of a third option? a fourth option? So it's kind of like everything. And so that's a common denominator of everything. And the reason why this is very significant and why it's a kind of like the root or one of the sources for it is that it's amazingly common that the clinging, the reactivity we have about what goes on, the resistance we have, the more complicated world of stories, ideas, justifications, meaning-making, philosophies, political positions that people have, can have their origin in the simple experience that something's unpleasant or something is pleasant. Something is pleasant, we want more of it. And so then we have to justify why we want more of it. And then we start creating a philosophy you really like oatmeal for breakfast. It's really pleasant to have oatmeal for breakfast. And so then that's nice, but then there comes a philosophy about how oatmeal is really important at Vipassana retreats. It's the Buddhist breakfast. And it creates just the right conditions. And when IMC opens its new retreat center, I need to write a letter to the president of the board explaining how important oatmeal is, not cornmeal, but oatmeal, and how we have a long history of oatmeal, and how the sensations of oatmeal in the mouth are just the right for experiencing impermanence. And so it becomes the oatmeal meditation center. And it all began because it was, this pleasantness and the desire for more pleasure. This complicated world arose. So the same thing can happen with something unpleasant. Sometimes oatmeal is unpleasant. Not another Vipassana retreat. It means oatmeal for breakfast. Oh no. It is Vipassana. I don't know if this Vipassana really works. They probably don't understand. These people, these Buddhists probably, they're too caught up in attachment and clinging. And I need a religion that really understands sensual pleasure and how important it is, and how important it is to have lots of sugar for breakfast. And I once taught in a retreat many years ago in Kansas City. And back then, at least, they seemed to have a very different diet than I was used to in California. And there was, on the side of the meditation hall, there was this room. I didn't know, I had no idea what was there. But I kept seeing people going into the room and leaving during the retreat, like a lot. So finally I got curious and to see what was going on in that room, that all the retreatants were going to this room. And there was, it was kind of like a kitchen. And there were piles of donuts and brownies and sweets. Which people there had, apparently the retreatants brought them along like Donna, potluck snacks or something. So I can reassure you, there are schools of Vipassana that have seen the light. And there's just not in California. And so, you could start creating a... So it's possible to create a whole, religious philosophy about the importance of sweets. Because here in California it's oatmeal. It's whatever. So you get the idea. I think you get the idea. I'm silly, right? But, so it's sometimes it's embarrassing how those of us who think we're sophisticated, the origins of our reactions, responses, belief systems have to do with a particular moment or moments of wanting pleasure or avoiding something uncomfortable. Or sometimes avoiding pleasure because we've been burned by it and don't want more of it. And sometimes wanting discomfort because somehow discomfort or something uncomfortable is actually reassuring, or it's It's what we're familiar with, or we think we deserve it, or something. But this movement towards these very simple things. And so it's a kind of like the common denominator. And so part of what we pay attention to, what we're encouraged to notice, is not to manufacture anything, but as we settle into our body, as we focus on the breath and calm down a little bit, start entering into the present moment, it kind of becomes kind of natural, but it helps to be told or pointed to this possibility that we become aware that not how complicated things are at the moment, but rather this some aspect of its simplicity of what's happening here now. And part of the simplicity is the basic feeling tone of the experience. I found it fascinating to do it. I've done it sometimes walking outdoors when it's been a sunny day, and noticing the simple experience of walking into the shade of trees and out into the sun, and how there's different movements inside of me, not just pleasant and unpleasant, but little movements of desire and not desire connected, or walking by certain people and seeing this, you know, somehow sometimes it's pleasant or unpleasant, but how quickly it gets complicated in the reactions and responses I have. Getting into a hot car and finding my mind thinking about, you know, why couldn't I get a car with an air conditioning? And then my mind wanders off about, why can't I buy a car with an air conditioner? Why can't I have a better job? Why can't I make more money? I should have gone to business school. And I was really led astray, and so the mind goes, okay, it all started because I got in the car, I was uncomfortable, and I wanted to get away from it, I wanted to do something about it. So to see this movement for and against, towards and away from, that arises out of this really simple thing, pleasant and unpleasant, can be extremely empowering. Can give a person a lot of strength, a lot of capacity, a lot of freedom, because then you can start noticing that you don't have to do anything with it. You don't have to build these universes and worlds on top of it. It can just be unpleasant. It can just be pleasant. The oatmeal can just be pleasant. The oatmeal can just be unpleasant. Doesn't mean anything has to happen. One of the relationships people have to pleasant and unpleasant is kind of a philosophy sometimes that of meaning. This means something. And the unpleasant in particular, there's some idea, I'm doing something wrong, or something's wrong about the situation if I'm not feeling pleasant, if this is unpleasant. Maybe I'm failing. So I've had that in meditation. So in the course of a retreat, if you're focusing on the breath can take many different shapes, many different ways of experiencing it, many different feeling tones connected to breathing. Sometimes it can be very satisfying. My experience of breathing is, great, how nice. This is really good. Boy, this is pleasant. Boy, I'm really a spiritual person. and there it is, right? It isn't just pleasant, but I've latched on to the pleasant and making a story with it. And sometimes I have what I call cardboard breath. And cardboard breath is not comfortable. It's not pleasant. It has no meaning to it. I mean, no important spiritual meaning that I can tell. It feels kind of dead. It doesn't seem like it's going to be doing me any good except getting oxygen in there. And it's not what I think is supposed to happen in my meditating. So I have suffered with my cardboard breath. And my reaction, this is unpleasant. And this unpleasant means that something is wrong. I'm doing something wrong. I'm not meditating right. And I have to figure out something to do. I'll start doing an engineering project with my breath to try to fix it. I'll go do yoga and try to fix it. I'll do all kinds of things. I'll try to do something. Or my favorite other route is to blame myself. And then I build a story about, how I'm a failure and such wonderful things, right? And what I learned eventually is that when I have cardboard breath, I am present for it as cardboard breath. I appreciate that I have this wonderful label for it. Cardboard breath, there it is. I know you. And I guess we're going to be keep each other company for a while. And I just breathe with cardboard breath. You know, that's not a big deal. It's not done, don't have to make a story of it. Yes, it's unpleasant. If you're only free when things are pleasant, you're not really free. So part of the training in a place like this is to recognize when things are unpleasant, to recognize when things are pleasant, and then train yourself, learn what it's like to leave it alone. Just let it be. It's okay. Don't have to make a story. Don't have to be a cling to it. Don't need to be for or against it. And it's a training. It's a we do here. Learn that process. So this common denominator of our experience, the pleasant and unpleasantness, and this neither place, is a useful thing to start noticing. And it's, as I said, it's very empowering. It can be very inspiring for some people to get a handle on their experience that makes it so simple. Because when the mind can make it so complicated, it can be really hard to get a handle on the situation and know the entry point and where the solution is or what to do. And it's quite, I find it quite remarkable that no matter how complicated, your mind can make your life, your story of your life. All those things they did to me and what I did and what we said and they said and what I have to do and who I am and what I can't, you know, just it gets so complicated what we create. If you step back and feel the mind making all these stories and all these complications, is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Or is it neither pleasant or unpleasant? Just notice that. And one of the things what's very helpful with noticing that is sometimes the reaction, the unpleasantness we have, when it's unpleasant, is the very thing that fuels more of the same. Because when things are unpleasant, so say for example, something's unpleasant, and so we tighten up to resist it maybe. Tightening up to resist it is also unpleasant. So we feel even more unpleasant. And what's a good response to feeling something strongly unpleasant? Is to tighten up even more. Or get worked up in the mind and make stories of it, which is even more unpleasant. And we can get, sometimes we can get on this kind of looping cycle. You know, it just gets more and more. And so part of what we're trying to do is to stop the looping and learn how to just leave something alone. Enough already. Let it just be unpleasant. And let it just be pleasant. So it's very meaningful to explore this. Now, in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, when the Buddha talks about the second foundation of this way of knowing, he makes a very interesting distinction between two kinds of feeling tones. Both kinds are pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. So they both have this, they have the quality they both have. So there's two categories. And the Pali word is, for one is sa-misa, and the other is nir-amisa. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, in his translation of this, he translated it as worldly feelings and spiritual feelings. The word in Pali means of the flesh or not of the flesh. And it's usually, some people translate it as one as being sensual pleasure and the other as spiritual or non-sensual pleasure. So what this refers to is that many of the feeling tones we have can be connected to our five or our six senses. So you know, if you get this delicious oatmeal, and it's you feel the pleasantness of it, you feel a taste. And so that's a sensual pleasure because it's happening in the senses of the tongue. If you go out and stand in the sun on a cool day and you feel the warmth against your skin, that's a sensual pleasure. If you hear a nice music, sounds against your ear, that's a sensual pleasure. So there's a lot of sensual pleasure people can have, or sensual displeasures, unpleasant that you can have. And that belongs to the world, you know, here is the flesh or the skin or the, you know, the ordinary senses that we have. And we know that some people can get intensely addicted to the world of sensual pleasures. And it can cause a tremendous, very complicated, the world we have in connection to our sensual pleasures. Some people get intensely spiritual, in quotation marks, around their sensual pleasures. Because sensual pleasures can be so wonderful and so take you out of your normal neurosis so nicely that you know, there can be great just a spiritual justification for doing these amazingly sensual things that are so pleasant because the high is so good and so wonderful. It's all fine, but it all belongs to that world of sensations. I don't think we need to be critical of it or, you know, done in the right way, in the wise way. But the Buddha also said there's a whole other category of feelings that are possible. This not of the flesh or not of the world, which maybe both are kind of don't quite work for me. I don't know if spiritual works either. I don't know what works. Is there a good translation of this Pali term? But this is the sensations we can experience, the feelings we can feel that arise from letting go, arise from getting settled, arise from feeling at home in this world, arise from being content and at peace. It's a whole different kind of feeling tone that the Buddha at least doesn't quite call, it's not really sensual. Though if you think about it, maybe you say, well, it's some inner senses are operating to feel this. So again, back to my childhood, when I was growing up in Italy, when I was about 11 or so, I took a public bus, home from school, and he bought a ticket. And the way it worked back then was there was a driver, and then there was a conductor who sold the tickets. And I was on one of the last stops on the bus route. So when we got near my stop, no one else was going to get on the bus. And so the conductor, who was selling a ticket seller, would take his ledger, his big ledger that he had, and he would sit at a particular seat in the middle of the bus. And he would go through all the different kinds of tickets he sold on that trip, one way, round trip, adult, children, you know, I don't know all the categories he had. And but lots of different kinds of tickets he had. And he would start methodically writing down in his ledger the different tickets he'd sold. And I learned that if I sat in a particular seat on the bus that was in front of the seat that he was going to sit on, I could look over his shoulder as he did his methodical thing on the ledger, and I would start feeling this beautiful glow in my chest. I'd feel so content and so happy. And you know, happy is probably not the right word, but so contented and happy and peaceful, and just kind of glowing feeling would glow from inside. You know, and later, I had no idea what was going on. I was almost not conscious that I was choosing that seat, and I never thought about it, just like, you know, afterwards or just... But when I started meditating, that's what it was. And, you know, you could say I was getting concentrated. I was getting, you know, borrowing his concentration or something. It was somehow that pulled me in. So there are sensations you can feel that aren't sensual in the fact that he wasn't massaging me, you know, or giving me oatmeal, which I love. I like oatmeal. So if anyone... No, I want to have a retreat center with oatmeal. And but there was something about the nature of my presence, the focus being in the present moment, the concentration, that went settling and letting go. There was allowing something to well up inside. That's what the Buddha was referring to, this other, second category, this non-sensual. And so this non-sensual can be both pleasant and unpleasant. The pleasant is that arises from these kinds of experiences of release, of freedom, of concentration, of subtleness, of being at home. The non-pleasant, ways described by the Buddha, primarily has to do with all the ways in which we get reactive in a negative way to not having those. We have an expectation, I'm supposed to get this way, I'm supposed to have these wonderful experiences, you know, I have to have them, or I'm, you know, or I can't get them, or something. Then it can, then the whole same kind of territory of our being can close up, you know. So when that, you know, so and maybe that, you know, example I gave of that 17-year-old telling me, "Don't be silly." When I felt all this awe and openness, and you know, being in this high mountain, beautiful place. Maybe that tightening of the heart, you know, metaphorical heart. Maybe that's the unpleasant feeling tone of the, you know, of the not of the flesh kind of thing. I think many people here in the West, we don't differentiate so strongly between these two. Maybe we don't have to, between the of the flesh and not the flesh. We lump them all together, varieties of pleasant and unpleasant. But the advantage of making the distinction between the two of them is that it's possible then to give a heightened appreciation and respect and attention to this inner life, the inner spiritual life, the inner openings that happen there. And that as we meditate and practice mindfulness, concentration, loving kindness, that we start appreciating there's, and recognizing there is something that's happening here that belongs to a different category of life, different aspect of life, different conditionality of life than the sensory world that we're often trying to fix and arrange and make better for us. And it's a world that's, the inner world is quite meaningful. And it can have, for example, it's possible to have this inner world, inner feeling, this non-sensual happiness and peace and joy, when the outer world, the world of sensual world, is very unpleasant. I've had very strong feelings of joy and contentment and happiness and peace, and had my body intensely painful. I've had feelings of ease and contentment that felt kind of spacious and open, and the external world, what was going on, was intensely unpleasant. There is this resource that's possible to tap into. You can't expect it to always be there. You better not measure yourself, your identity around it. You'll suffer. But it's helpful to appreciate when it's there and to learn to recognize it, because the validation of it, the appreciation of it, is part of what nourishes it and allows it to grow and develop. And so yesterday Heather talked about the small mind and the big mind. The big mind isn't just, you know, an empty mind that has, you know, just neutral and blank, has no feeling connected to it. But the big mind is connected to this, the feelings not of the flesh, these spiritual feelings, or not of the world, or whatever. You know, I don't know the right word for it. And it's kind of like, if back to the fist thing, a little bit like, you know, you have certain sensations in your hand if you make a fist for a long time. And if you do it for a long time, you start having unpleasant feelings and sensations. But if you release the fist, if you'd held it for a while, there's this really nice, maybe freeing of blood or nerves or that feels very beautiful and kind of vital and alive that can happen there. Same thing happens kind of like that when the mind begins to release its clinging and the heart begins to open up. There's a vitality and a freedom and a flow and a openness or a warmth or a joy, delight, sense of well-being, contentment, or peace, or tranquility. Different times, you know, different ways in which it's felt. It can be very, very subtle, just a little hint of it there. It can be quite strong. And the recognition of it, as I say, to recognize a difference between these, sensual and non-sensual, is just kind of matter of fact, just recognizing different aspects of our life, how it is at different times. But also, it helps us to recognize a distinction that is meaningful for where we put our attention, where we put our sense of purpose, where we get our, where we look for our well-being or happiness. And for people who only know how to be happy, or I don't know if it's really happy, but to get joy or meaning in life through the sensory world of things, if that's all you know, then it makes sense to go, you know, full tilt ahead into that world and try to arrange it. Make it, you know, make it just work just fine. Get all the everything lined up so it's just always pleasant. But if you know there's an alternative, some other way of feeling a deep contentment, maybe even much deeper, deeply embodied, deep in the heart, deep kind of full, something that's bigger, larger than anything, then you're not going to put all your eggs in the basket of the world. You can also put some of your investment of your time, your interest, your what you do with yourself, your sense of purpose, your direction, your intention. You can also go towards something that's different, something that many people don't know about, something that's, you know, in a sense not of this world, but it's not like of any other world. It's here. It's very real. In some ways, it's more real than anything else. The last thing I'll say about it is that part of the value of beginning to appreciate this non-sensual pleasure, joy, pleasantness, as it begins to grow, kind of slowly, it doesn't thaw, but maybe it warms up. So our clingings thaw and our freedom warms up. Is that now I forgot what I was saying. So let me see if it comes back. Distracted myself. Oh yes. Isn't that nice that it came back? The feeling tone, the sensation of this pleasant sensation of contentment or peace or ease or well-being or whatever it might be, doesn't belong to the world of thinking. It's not, you don't think your way into it. Thinking is nice. Can be nice. Thinking has its place. It's a wonderful thing to do. Thinking can happen out of that place. Thinking then has a very nice feeling tone to it when that happens. But it's not of thinking. And so when we start having a visceral sense of this inner well-being that's not of the world of thought, then it's possible, we realize that thinking is not as important as we have been thinking. Thinking usually overrates itself. Thinking thinks it's very important. And we need to help the thinking mind be appreciated, feel valued. It's kind of insecure, our thinking mind, so it's good to kind of pat it on its back and you know, so it's okay, you're doing fine. So it doesn't, you know, because it'll think even more if it feels threatened. It's okay, you're okay now. And then you can begin tuning in or putting your attention more in that part of your experience which has nothing to do with thoughts at all. And your thoughts can sometimes recede. They're still going on, but they recede. It's almost as if you're not really in your thoughts. You're not living your thoughts. They can do what they do, but you're living an embodied life. You're living a life that has this freedom to it, this ease to it, this openness to it. That's where the way forward is for you. So, a way of knowing. We can know the common denominator of our experience, whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant. And from time to time, it's not easy. Don't set yourself up to suffer more here. From time to time, you might become aware that there's feelings, sensations happening within that don't really belong to the sensual world, sensations, the ordinary sensations, but seem to arise not because of any good reason, like, you've won the lottery or got a massage or there's oatmeal or something. It's arising, kind of bubbling up out of some deep wellspring of well-being. And when those moments happen, it's important not to cling to it. But it's really useful to appreciate it and value it. And if you try to cling to it, you'll do the same thing that'll happen if you have your open hand, and it feels so good to have an open hand, you decide you want to cling to it, and you make a fist. I got it. I got it. The open hand is gone. As soon as you try to cling to the open hand, by tightening up, you've lost it. As soon as you try to cling to the pleasant sensations not of the flesh, they go. So study your clinging. Become a connoisseur of clinging. Appreciate your clinging. So you know it so well, you know all its tricks. And then one day, it'll be easier to let go. And then you can appreciate the other side. So, let's take a moment to gather together.